Try the following format. This is an IPython notebook. I'm going to type everything into here. I've also, of course, some notes prepared. And afterwards, I'm going to upload it to the wiki. And you can also have access to the course notes. So you don't need to type anything that's here on the screen. Regarding the wiki, thanks for sending me the usernames. I haven't actually added anybody. But it would be good if some of you could help me maintain the wiki. For example, I sent out an email with a short summary of what we did last week. You could just add it to whatever we did last week. And also maybe add that notebook. Well, I'm going to have to do that, I guess. So, major news, Julia 0.4 has been released. That's the version we are going to be using. I think once a month or something, there'll be updates with bug fixes and so on, but nothing major. You can just continue to use the version that you've been using. There's a doodle poll about the course time. So far, this time and the Wednesday morning time look equally bad. And another option would be to do it Thursdays from 4 to 6. The good time is that we'll ensure that we finish on time at 5:30. So please all fill in the poll, otherwise your voice will not be heard. So I gave you a bit of homework in the email, I think. And the homework was to write a program that counts from 1 to 10. And the standard solution looks like this. Can you still all see that, all the people in the back? A larger font, yes, no, maybe? No, good, you're not complaining. And then, of course, if you run that, kernel has to start, it outputs the number from 1 to 10. There's another way to implement that, and that is called a list comprehension. That is this one here, where you have this array, and this is I, for I in 1 to 10, which is the same thing. The one above actually outputs the number from 1 to 10. This returns an array with the numbers of 1 to 10, which is actually more convenient because you can reuse the output. And of course, the user interface outputs the values. Something even shorter is where you directly use the range object, this 1:10. Collect is a general function. Every kind of container collection you have, you put collect around of it, and the values get collected into an array. So if you have tree or set or any kind of structure, want to convert it to an array, an array is the natural data structure for Julia, then you can wrap it into collect, and then it turns into an array. Well, same thing up here. But in most cases, you don't actually need to collect anything. If you have a more abstract representation, for example, here, that kind of range object, you can just use it like that. For example, in the for loop above, we had this 1:10. There's no need to put a collect around it because for knows how to iterate. Everything knows how to iterate over this range object. So, of course, this just returns the range object unevaluated. And so all of these would be valid solutions of the homework. And what I'm kind of expecting from you by now, that you should be able to do this homework on your own. Okay. Now, the topic of today's lecture is types, the type system. And the thing that sets Julia apart, one of the two things, is the type system that it has. And it's different from C++ because Julia is more dynamic than C++. So the type system is, in a sense, a strict superset of the type system of C++. And on the other hand, it's also very different from Python because in standard Python, of course, every object has a particular type and so on. But you don't, if you have a variable, you can't annotate variables with what type it holds. And this is one of the major sources of efficiency of Julia, that they kind of were able to strike a really good thing, a really good middle ground here. So the thing about types is every value that you have, every object has exactly one type. And this type is also called a concrete type because you can have an object of the type. And there's a function type of that returns the type. So let's play around with that a bit. There's the value 1, which is, of course, just the value 1. The type of 1 is int, integer, 64-bit integer on that machine. Let's look a few other types here. So 1.0 is, man, why is it so slow? Is a floating point number, a is a character, and 1.5 plus 2.5i, that's a complex number. Actually, a 64-bit complex number. And the thing about types in Julia is that they're reified. That means types are themselves objects in Julia, and that's not possible in C++. If you compile C++ at runtime, all the type information has been lost, except some rudimentary things for virtual function calls and so on. Whereas in Julia, types are still present. They're still objects. You can do things with types. For example, we can look at type of 1 that was int 64. Now we look at the type of int 64, since it's an object, it has a type itself. That is data type, and the type of data type, well, the bug has to stop somewhere, is also data type. Okay, we can Also, since types are things, you can compare them. Is int equals to int 64? Yes, it is. And it's not equal to float 64. These are different. And you can define an alias for a type, which is just a new name for a type that already exists. You can, for example, say I equals int. It is very similar. Here you use a type alias, I int, and the result is int 64. And if you look at the value of I, int 64. So you just defined a new alias. It's just a new name for the same type. There's nothing, there's no difference between them. So far, so good. There's a type hierarchy in the sense of object-oriented programming, but because of the way Julia is designed, this object-oriented aspect is much less important than in other languages. In C++, Java, or maybe even Python, it's probably more implemented. Well, not in Python, it's also not that important. I think they call it duck typing, where you don't really define the type, but types and objects are more or less classified by their behavior, not by how you declare them. So there's, for example, I mentioned the concrete types before. Every value, every object has a concrete type. There are also abstract types. And every concrete type has exactly one super type, and that is an abstract type. And thus, of course, that naturally forms a hierarchy. So we can look at int. There's integer is one abstract type. There's abstract float, and there's number. And there's also a type called any. So any is the thing, I think it's called object in Java. It's the super type of any other type. So in Python, if you declare a variable, it would have the type any because you can store anything in there. And now let's get to the differences to Python. There's the colon-colon operator that is called a type assertion. It checks whether a value has a certain type, throws an error if that's not the case. There's a function isA that checks whether it has a certain type, returns true, false. And there's this less than colon operator, the subtype operator that compares two types and checks whether one is a subtype of the other type. So if we let's check whether one is of type int. Yep. I mean, it just checks and returns the type, right? It doesn't return true, false, it just checks. Let's check whether one is of type float 64. Nope, we get a type error. And is one an integer? Yes. Is one int? Yes. One integer? Yes. Is int a subtype of integer? Yes. Sorry, you probably can't see that now. Is int a subtype of int? Yes, it is, in the sense that both are equal. Is int a subtype of number? Yes. Integer is a number? Yes. Number any? Yes. And so on. I'm just introducing a few types here. And the distinction between concrete and abstract types is that if you have a value, an object, the type it has is always a concrete type. And abstract types live above that, forming the hierarchy. Now let's look at the two super types. Well, look at the super type for int, actually. Yes?
Can you repeat what is the difference between integer and int?
Yes. Int is a concrete type, and integer is an abstract type. That have similar names, it's a bit confusing. So for float, that shows different name. There's float is the concrete type, and abstract float is the abstract type. And there are different integer types. There's Boolean, kind of a one-bit integer, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128 bits, and there's also a big int of arbitrary precision, and they're all subtypes of integer. Okay, yeah, there's also a distinction between signed and unsigned types. Anyway, the super type of integer is real, because, I mean, that is how the hierarchy goes. The super type of real is number, the super type of number is any, and the super type of any is any again. It has to stop somewhere. And since it's a tree structure, there's exactly one super type, and there's a distinct set of subtypes. So the subtypes of number are, there are two subtypes, they're real and complex numbers. And now you can look at the subtypes of real and so on and so forth. And this funny notation here with complex t less than real, that is all complex types that, I don't know that what you would call that, the complex types are kind of, oh man, I like the English word. There's kind of an underlying field of the complex type. And if that field is a real number, then complex numbers form a real. But in Julia, you could also find complex type of character or something. I mean, you could at least write it down. But of course, if you then add these things, you couldn't add them. That wouldn't make sense. but a priori you could do that, kind of define complex types over some other type. So as long as that other type is a real type, then you have a number. And if you want to play with the type system, get some experience here, and then just homework. Well, my homeworks are only suggestions because I know your time is limited. You're not getting any credit, so probably none of you are going to do that. But you take it as a suggestion. Find out what subtypes of number there are and kind of try to define the tree. And if you want to do calculations with Julia in terms of real complex numbers, integers, then it's kind of nice to see what exists there and what types exist, because you'll discover things like rational numbers that are implemented in Julia and so on. And if you just look at subtypes of numbers, subtypes of complex, subtypes of real, and so on, or maybe just look at the documentation, Google for this type tree, that would be another way to solve that homework, then you'll find that. Okay, that is this. Another topic that I tried to explain last time, and where I failed on the blackboard, apologies for that, is variables and bindings. So in Julia, a value is something like a box with whatever, some black box content, and a variable is something like a label you put onto the box. On the blackboard, I had variables and then draw an arrow to the particular value. And if you assign something to a variable, that doesn't mean that you change the content of the box. It just means you change the label of the box, or you draw a different arrow. Let me try to do it again on the blackboard. Can you all see it if I draw something here? Probably yes. Let's say we have a variable x, and x has the value 1. So this is the value 1. And then we have a pointer here. And then let's see that we assign the value 2 to x. Then there's another value. And what we then do, exchange the value. X now points to 2, but the value 1 does not change at all. And I have some examples here that makes that maybe more clear. So this bracket notation with 1 in, that means this is an array with 1 element. And that element happens to be 1. So if you assign this array to a variable, then we have a 1 element array that holds the value 1. If we say b equals a, then of course b points to the same value. And that is now something that I wanted to also clarify here on the blackboard. So we have this array that is 1, and then we said b equals a, then b and a point to the same thing. And we compare a and b, they're the same. Now, if I change the array element, the first element of a to be 2, that is a, the first array element, if I change it to 2, then the value of b changes as well. If I output a and b, they are both 2. And the comparison was the 2 equal signs. There's also a comparison that checks for object identity, where you don't look at the value but the objects, where I compare a and b. And there you see that a and b actually hold the same object, so they point to the same object. Now, if c is a copy of a, then this looks like this, because you made a copy of a. This is now a different object, also holding 2. If we compare them with a single equal sign, looking for equality, yes, it's true. If we look for object identity, no, it's not the same object. It's 2 objects, 2 arrays holding different values. And now if we output all A, B, C, they all are 2. If we change A of 1 to 3, set A of 1 to 3, A of 1, we set this to 3, and then output all 3 values, then it's clear what the output should be. It's 3, 3, 2, because C is an independent copy. And this property of Python, that if you assign to a variable, you change the binding, you don't change the value of the object itself. It's different from C++, may confuse a few people, but it's the same as in Python. If you know C++, you can think of it as if every variable was holding a pointer to a variable or maybe a shared pointer, then you get the same behavior as in Julia. Now, a plus equals 1, that means we take the value of a, which is an array, we add 1, and the result is again assigned to a. So we take this one here, 3, we add 1, then we get a new value, 4, and then we assign the result to a. So this is what we then expect. If we were to write this in C++, we would change the 3 to 4, and that arrow would still be pointing here. That's the difference. So we do this and look at, and they all have different values, and they're all distinct now. Yep.
If I create some type of my node that has a lot of fields in it, and then I initialize two objects that have exactly the same value for all of the fields.
Yes.
And they are A and B, and they are, then I do A equals A equals B.
Yes.
And compare all the fields.
Yes. Yes, it would do that.
So even if you have separate objects, if they have all the same fields, it does.
Yes, so if you define your own types, then by default you get the comparison operator that combines them field by field, if you use the two equal signs. With the three equal signs, if you have two objects, they of course would be different.
Of course, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Was that about object and identity? I hope it was clearer, although I realize I was probably drawing the same diagram last time. So. Maybe it's just clearer because I repeat it. Okay. When you declare a variable, you can put a type constraint on it. That means this variable can only hold values of that particular type. And this is important for efficiency because if the compiler knows ahead of time what type the variable has, then it does not need to check what type it is at runtime. And this is one of the sources of efficiency of Julia. And this is not possible in standard Python. It's possible in some of the modifications of Python, for example, in Cython or CPython.
CPython is just Python.
Sorry, yes, Cython. Yes, CPython is the standard Python. That's confusing. Anyway, so this is a function that I call decl1. I have one local variable that I set to 1, I equals 1, and the last value in a function is what the function returns. So if I execute the statement, it first defines a function, then it calls the function. This, of course, outputs 1. Here I do the same thing, except that I define the local variable I to only be able to hold integer values. Since 1 is an integer, this is exactly the same as the function above. Nothing happens. Here, I define the variable I to only be able to hold integer values, and then I assign 1.0 to it. 1.0 is a floating point value. So now, Julia will convert the floating point value to an integer value. And that, of course, has the same result, 1 again. If I try to assign 1.1 to that integer variable, this does not work. It's an inexact error because 1.1 cannot be represented exactly as an integer. In C or other languages, you would automatically round that value in some way. In Julia, if you want to round that, you have to explicitly call a rounding function. For example, you can take the value 1.1 and take the floor. You find the next lower integer and convert it to an integer that way. Of course, you can also round to the nearest number or next number above it, and so on. That adds a bit of type safety. So note that these type annotations only work with local variables within a function. They do not work with global variables. Global variables are visible everywhere for all the modules that you write, and the compiler knows very little about them. There is very little safety, and that therefore much less efficient than local variables. Global variables are essentially stored in a dictionary, same as in Python. So everything you type, you assign a variable here at the top level something, for example, what we did, a equals 1 above, that defines a global variable. So if you want to play with types, so with efficiency of Julia, you have to write a function. This is why I put these things into functions. Okay. Hope it's not getting too boring. This is now getting a bit more interesting. There are parameterized types. If we look at complex 128, this type here, you will see that it's actually internally represented as complex of float 64. Float 64 is the regular 64-bit, the double precision floating point number. So when complex numbers are implemented in Julia, they didn't implement several different versions. There was just one implementation, and it takes as a parameter the corresponding real type, and then you get complex numbers of arbitrary types. So for example, you have complex of single precision numbers, you can have complexes of integers, complexes of booleans, and of course the same thing for vectors and matrices over double precision and arrays This, for example, is an array with 10 dimension. It doesn't have size 10. It's a 10-dimensional array of double precision values. And these are all type parameters. This is how you define a regular type. You type int point, so it's a point with integer coordinates. You say x and y are integers. And then you can create a new value of the type by calling the constructor 1,2. And if you output the type, it's int 1,2. And p.x has the value 1, as you'd expect. You can also define parameterized types, and it gets a bit more interesting. This is a point of t with curly braces. X and y have the type t. And if you create a point int of this value, then of course it looks the same as above. So this type point int is equivalent to the int point above. It's a different type, but of course it has equivalent functionality. Now we can also look at a point with floating point numbers. As you see, if we take p2, that was the int point above. I should use the hockey stick here. p2 was point of int. X and y must be integers. If we try to assign 1.1, that is not integer. That is an inexact error, a type error. With 0.3, of course, it should work just fine because that can hold floating point values. And there's also a type any. Any is the type that can't hold any values. So this is how things, the default behavior that would be in Python. You can assign it 1.2, and then later on you can change p.x to be hello, because it can hold anything that is not very safe, but sometimes you may need that. I don't know why I added that here. Oh, yes. Point is a parameterized type. This is a constructor. If you leave out the type here, then it will automatically choose the type. If you just point 1.1, 2.2, then Julia chooses the float 64 here. If you write strings, then you'll get a pointer string, although it doesn't make sense. Int point and the point int, although they're equivalent, are not the same types. And now the important part, int is a subtype of number. Point int is not a subtype, hello, of point number. And also not the other way around. And that last property here, that is called invariance. So this are where different languages actually differ slightly. If you have point int and point number, and if you have a routine that expects a number as input, and the routine would expect point number, then it could also handle point int as input, because there's a natural transformation from point int to point number, because every integer is a number. It can be naturally converted. But not the other way around. Point number can't be converted to int because numbers can't be converted to int. Correspondingly, if you have an algorithm that produces a point of number, sorry, a point int, then it can also be made to produce point of number because of this natural transformation. And in other languages, there is sometimes much discussion about whether you want to have this invariant, covariant, or contravariant behavior, in particular if you're used to object orientation. And I believe C++ is used to be contravariant, now they switched to being covariant for return types, and so on. In Julia, this is invariant, which is simpler. And since object orientation in Julia is not so important, that point is not as relevant as in other languages. Okay, from your glazy eyes, I think that this last type may have, last point may have been a bit too theoretical. It depends on what experience you have in object-oriented programming. If you come from a see where they can switch that off. If you come from a background with more dynamical languages, Mathematica and Python, this will be nothing to you. If you come from a background of Java, C++, and so on, this would be important to you. Another homework suggestion, if you want to play around with types and get this under your hood, I recommend that you can define a Spinor or a quaternion type. This should be an a parameterized type over any field that you specify. You have quaternions of real, quaternions of integers, or quaternions of other quaternions, if you so want. You should, to make this a real example, at least implement addition and multiplication of quaternions, maybe also scaling by a real number. And you can, of course, if you want to cheat, look at one of the existing Julia packages that implement, I don't know, I think the volume control is over there, that implement quaternions and can do it this way. If quaternion is too much for you, you can, of course, also implement complex numbers or something similar.
Maybe it'll become.
Oh, no, please do. Please do. Please do.
What exactly does it mean if something's a supertype of another type? Like, what is guaranteed?
Nothing. In C++, if you have abstract virtual base classes, then you have associated functions with these base classes. Mm-hmm. And the subtypes must all implement the same functions, and then you can call these functions. In Julia, that is not the case, because Julia isn't really object-oriented in that way. You don't have functions that live inside a class. All functions live outside a class. So there's basically nothing guaranteed. That is more of a documentation issue of more than expectation. So you can define anything to be a number, but what it means to be a number, you probably have to find that in the documentation. And personally, I think a number includes that you have some kind of algebra. You can probably divide things, but maybe you get a different type if you divide something, right? Integers. If you divide integers, the result may not be integer anymore.
But this is not enforced by the
This is not enforced at all yet. And there are ways to enforce that. I'm going to get to that near the end of the lecture. But I hope that's not getting too theoretical for the others. Maybe we can do it as an add-on for those that are interested. You can also have abstract parameterized types. For example, there's a matrix type in Julia, and there's an abstract matrix type. There are different matrix types. So there is a matrix is an abstract matrix. And here you have a sparse matrix. CSC is the compressed sparse column format that is one of the widely used formats for sparse matrices. And that's also an abstract matrix. And now you may wonder, if you have a matrix of reals, is that a subtype of matrix of complex numbers? Because if an algorithm can handle complex inputs, it surely can also handle real inputs. But that's not the case. That is, again, the point of invariance. Because if an algorithm can output complex numbers, if you feed it real numbers, there's no guarantee that the algorithm would then also produce real numbers. The output may still be complex. And thus, that saying that real is subtype of complex is true, but for matrices, that does not make sense anymore. And if you want to have more information about these types, sparse matrices, for example, you can look at the help system about matrices, sparse matrices, and then you find out that sparse matrix itself is a module that's defined in base, all the base library of Julia. And there are these three keywords that Julia knows. There's a CSC, compressed sparse column. There's also a compressed sparse row format that's apparently not implemented, and abstract sparse matrix. Now, if you define a parameterized type, Julia automatically defines an abstract type. So if you define matrix of int, that's a concrete type, then matrix is an abstract type, and it's automatically a subtype of that. Is matrix int a subtype of matrix any? Mm-hmm. No, it's not. That's again the invariance thing. Int is a subtype of any, but matrix int and matrix any have no relation. Matrix int, of course, is a subtype of any, but between these new matrix types, nothing. That is, again, invariance. Let's define a matrix of integers, and this notation in the square brackets 1 space 2 colon 3 space 4 defines a 2 by 2 matrix. So if a 2 by 2 array, matrix is just an array. And if you leave out the int, then Julia will automatically look at the argument and determine the type itself. So here you get again an array. And where did I leave the hockey stick? You see that the result is the same. You define matrix int. The result is a two-dimensional array of ints. And if you just say matrix, then you again get a two-dimensional array of ints. But this int type is automatically deduced because the input here was all integers.
What's the meaning of the two after int?
That is rank 2. It's two dimensions. So 2 by 2, that's the sizes, two rows, two columns. And the last comma 2 means that it's rank 2. So a matrix is always rank 2. And you can, of course, hang whatever rank 100 arrays as well.
So it's worth noting that
parameterized type of array that has chosen two.
Yes, very good. And there's also a name vector, and a vector is just the shorter name, type alias of one-dimensional arrays. Okay. And if you create abstract matrix, then this is apparently implemented to default to a regular dense matrix, also deduces everything. So this is how you, we had how to define types. If you want to define types, you also want to define constructors. So let's define a type, a point type similar to the one above, x and y at integers, but the constructor takes only a single argument. Before, we didn't define any constructor, and we can just create points by giving it two arguments that then correspond to x and y. Here, we define allow only one type, and then we create a new special point where x is equals to x and y is also equal to x, so first and second element of the type. Just set the argument that we pass in. If we create the point of 1, 2, that's now an error because there's no constructor that takes two arguments. And we can then, of course, call the constructor with a single argument, which gives us a point, kind of a diagonal point, where both points are set to 1. And afterwards, of course, you can modify the point if you want and set the second element to 2. So the constructor that we just defined was defined inside the type that is called an inner constructor. And these are usually used to implement constraints or invariants about types. They're not really supposed to be convenient to use. And we can also add a function special point with the same name of the type that is then called an outer constructor. And if we define this function, which calls the constructor we had before, then we have a constructor that uses that can use two arguments. Okay. I don't know whether I'm going too slow or too fast, or whether this has too much detail, but it seems to me I should speed up or do something with this lecture. Let's talk about functions, how you decline functions. That's a bit more practical again. Let's define a function, add x and y. This is just the way it is, x equals y. This is a way to define a function. We can define, put type constraints on the arguments, x and y. Then this function add int can only be called with integer arguments. So if you call add 2 and 3, it's 5. Add 2.0 and 3.0, this of course calls this add function here, it's 5.0, because it works for any type, in this case for floating point numbers as well. If you call the add int function with integers, it works. If you call it with floating point numbers, we get a type error. This is what the type annotation does. It provides you safety. If you have a function that expects an integer and someone is passing in a string, you get the error message right away, which is convenient when you program something. Here we have a parameterized function. So in curly braces, after the function I'm t and u, and then we have x, which has type t, y, and type u. We can define this, and when you call this function, then Julia looks at the arguments, types of the arguments, and this defines the values of these type parameters. This add param is, of course, the same as the original add. We just introduced explicit names, so you could just write x and y, because we don't do anything with the values t and u. So this is the same as the original add function above, when you just write add x comma y equals x plus y. Here, more complicated, we have a function, but there's only one parameter where x and y both have types t. So if we call this function with two integers, then t is integer, all is fine, it works just. If you call with an integer and a float, then this is a type error because there's no single type t that can match that function signature. And this corresponds roughly to function templates in C++, but the constraints you can put on the types is more powerful than C++. So this definition here is something you could not write in C++. So here we say x and y have to have a type t. It has to be the same type t, and t has to be a subtype of integer. Let's do that. If you call it with integer types, then it works fine. And if you call it with non-integer types, then that would be an error. And I'm sneakily introducing big here. So big converts integers to big integers. A big integer is something that has an arbitrary position. It's a small expression, big one, it looks like one. The type of is big int. If you calculate 10 to the 20, then the result is, well, this does not look like 10 to the 20, because 10 to the 20 should have many zeros at the end. What of course happens, this is an integer overflow, and Julia doesn't detect that. And if we use big integers, then the calculation is presumably slower, but exact. Yes?
When you gave the specification that e must be a subtype of integer, does that help the compiler already optimize something?
Very good. No, it does not. I actually have a section on that later on. When the compiler compiles the function, it doesn't compile the function when you define them. It only compiles them when you actually call them. So if you have a function f calling g, and when you define f, g is not yet defined, that's perfectly fine. Only when you call f must g be defined. And at that point, the compiler looks at the types of the function arguments and then specializes the function for the types that you've actually used. This is similar to what C++ function templates would be. And the only thing that matters is the actual types of the arguments that you pass in, and that determines the speed with which the function is executed. And in Python, I believe, if you use regular Python, there's one generic version of the function that is compiled, and that then needs to do many runtime checks to handle the various types. So by compiling multiple versions of the function for different argument types, this is one of the reasons to get the performance in Julia.
It's not just a performance issue in Python either. Because in Python, if you want to use overloading for different types, then you have to explicitly put the flow control in your code, and it's very cumbersome.
Okay. Yes, very good.
But if I want, the reason I would write something like he must be a subclass of integer would be mainly for documentation and safety purposes.
Yes. But also for overloading,
yeah.
If you want to have different algorithms. Yeah, I don't know whether I have an example. But for example, if you want to multiply two matrices, you can have a generic routine for multiplying matrices. And then you say, well, if one of them is real and the other one is complex, then I want to do that as a special case, because multiplying real by complex is faster than multiplying two complex numbers. And converting real to complex and then multiplying is really doing too much work or something. Or you want to have different algorithms. You have a sparse matrix, then an SVD decomposition may look different than if you have a dense matrix and so on. So this is also, this is another feature in Julia. And there's also something that is, in C++, you'd have to do it differently. You have to have if statements or something to do that decision in runtime. Yeah. Here I just want to show that if you have these constraints here, sort of parameterized functions, it doesn't have to be the name of the the type of the argument. You can also be something else. For example, you have a p is a point of type 2, q point of type t, what we defined above, and t is a subtype of number. And then we add these points by adding px plus qx. And since this is a number, I kind of assume that that type defines an add operation. But that is something that is not actually expressed in the language, that numbers need to support addition. And if I have points with integer values and add them, it's fine. And if I have points of characters and want to add them, I get again a type error, because that add points function here doesn't match point of character. If t is character, then t is not a subtype of number. Okay, this is the point about efficiency that we discussed earlier, that these subtype declarations and functions are basically not necessary for efficiency. They're just for correctness and for choosing different algorithms. Okay. So this is kind of the first half of my lecture, where I give an overview over the type system. And if you used object-oriented or parameterized types before, you have something nice to compare. If you haven't done anything like that in programming, then it may have been a bit boring and a bit different. Now, in the second half of my lecture, I'm trying to go a bit more into computer science or category theory or things like that. I hope that some of you might find that interesting. We'll see about that. So what is a type? A type is essentially a set of values. If you think in mathematics, what a set is, then there are two definitions of what a set. There's the naive set theory that I learned in elementary school. A set is essentially a bag, and you put things into it, and the things are called elements. And if you want to represent it, then you put symbols on a blackboard and circles or ellipses around it, and then have union and complement and intersection and things like that. And of course, if you have a set, one of the interesting things you can put into a set is another set. So you have sets of sets, and then you can easily construct things like the set of all sets that contain themselves, or the set of all sets that don't contain themselves. And if you think about whether that set contains itself, then you find out it doesn't have an answer. So somewhere without actually specifying axioms, you argued yourself into a corner. And then you can do axiomatic set theory, and turns out that is unfortunately horribly complicated. I think you need of the order of 10 axioms just to define what a set is, and what you then get is just sets. I mean, no elements. The only thing you can put into a set is other sets, and if you even want to define numbers, you have to define an equivalence relation between sets and numbers, and it's horribly complicated, and 10 axioms for something like sets, I don't know, I don't like that. I think you need 2 or 3 axioms to define what a vector space is, and think of the field of linear algebra, how fruitful that is. Well, you need other things, right? You need scalar products and norms and so on. Anyway, there's category theory, and I quite like category theory because that provides a nice axiomatic system that solves these problems. The problem with category theory is that it's typically not taught in undergrad courses or in high school, and some of the introductions are really, really abstract mathematically, but if you scourge the internet these days, you probably found something like category theory for the physicist or for the engineer or for a computer scientist, and that provides a nicer introduction. So if you place naive set theory with category theory, then a type is a category, not a set, but of course it's really the same thing. And all these contradictions with what is a set, or set of all sets that don't contain themselves, these are then nicely solved. Now, a type is then essentially a set, and things like point, what we defined above, I mean point of int is a set, but point is a type and therefore a set, but point, of course, just the point itself, is not really a type. It is something like a type constructor. You take a type such as integer, then you apply point to it, and then you have a point of integer or a vector of integer. So that is then called a functor in category theory, or a type constructor in other languages. And that's not too confused with the value constructors that you know from C++ and so on. And unfortunately, there's another thing that computer scientists sometimes call a functor that is very different from that point being a functor. I don't know where that, well, for what historic reasons people made up the name functor for something else. Now, if you have types, you can define a product of these types, the product types, they're called tuples. And if you have an integer and a floating point number and a character, you can define a tuple of these. Looks like that. If tuple notation in Julia just uses curly braces and commas in between, for example, 1, 2.0, the type of that, of course, a tuple of int and float. If you just have 1, you need a bit of an ugly trailing comma there. I think Python does the same thing. That is a tuple that contains the same integer. That is, of course, equivalent to using a single integer, but nevertheless, it's a distinct type. And there's also just empty braces, which is an empty tuple. And this notation of using curly braces and something in between is the same notation that is used for function arguments, and that is not a coincidence. In Julia, function arguments are actually a tuple that is passed. So it uses the same mechanism. And here we have a function as an example that returns multiple values. So it is a function that takes 2 inputs, x and y, and it returns a tuple of x and y. This is how you would return multiple values in Julia. So it returns a tuple. And if you construct a tuple out of several types, then of course each type corresponds to a set or a category, is a certain number of elements in that set, and the tuple set, the number of elements in there is the product of the number of elements in the individual sets. That's why it's called a product type. And if you want to represent a certain type, A, and that type has a certain number of elements, then the number of bits you need to represent that is just the binary logarithm of that. And the question is, if you have an empty tuple, how many bits do you need to represent that? Someone make a guess, please. So the empty tuple is kind of the unit element, and tuples are products. So the empty tuple has
one
element. So you need 0 bits to represent that. And we can do that here. Size of an integer here is 8 bytes. Size of a character in Julia is 4 bytes. And if you have a tuple of an integer and character, then I expect 8 plus 4 equals 12. Due to your internal restrictions, there's also 4 bytes of padding added, so it's actually 16 bytes that you need to represent the tuple. There's a value called nothing, which is equivalent to an empty tuple, which outputs nothing. And the type of nothing is void, and the size of void is 0. This corresponds to the void in C++. If a function returns void, it corresponds to returning a type like that. Of course, in C++, void is not a real type, and in Julia, it is. And this is a type that has only one value, namely nothing, and thus requires 0 bits to represent it. And of course, if you have 0 bits, right, there's no work involved in returning that value. That is exactly what that means, that you return nothing. And we talked about invariance and covariance before. So is int a subtype of tuple of int? No, it's not, although the types are equivalent. Tuple int is that subtype of integer, of tuple of integer. For point, that was false, but for tuples, it is actually true. Tuples are an exception to the rule that types in Julia are invariant, tuples are covariant. So if int less than integer, then tuple containing int is a subtype of tuple of integer. It's only true for tuples, not for vectors. Those are product types. You can also define co-product types, or sum types, that is a union. The union you may know from C or C++ are different. Let me take a step back. If you have two sets and you take a union of the set, then usually you would eliminate duplicate elements. If you take a disjoint union, which is what this union type correspond to, then you keep the duplicates in the set. You essentially mark each element with a set from where it comes from. So if you have a set 1, 2, 3, and another set 1, 2, 4, and you take the disjoint union, then you have 1, 2, 3, 1', 2', 4'. So the number of elements in the disjoint union is always the sum of the number of elements. There is no unification happening. And if you have a union of types, for example, a union of int and character is a type that can hold either an integer or in character. And you have a type that can also hold an 8-bit integer or a 16-bit integer, then it can do that. But the value 0 can be represented in two different ways. It can either be 0 of 8-bit or a 0 of 16-bit integer. And the distinction is kept. So that is a union, which looks like that. A union is actually a supertype of int. This is false, because there are integer values that cannot be represented. And that this is actually true, because if the union can hold integer values, then of course it can also hold any subtypes of integers that includes the ints. Union of int just collapses to being a single int. That's a major difference to tuple types. And if a union of int and integer, then this is exactly integer, because int is already a subtype of integer. And if you have the empty union, that's the empty union. We talked about the empty tuple before. The empty union, how many elements are in that set? The empty union is kind of the neutral element, and they are called sum types. So the empty union has 0 elements in it. And how many bits do you need to represent 0 elements? That would be the log of 0, which is not defined. So there is no value that is in that set. So if you declare a variable of that type, then that variable, you cannot use the variable. It must remain undefined. It's probably an error to define a variable of the type, because the variable cannot have any value, because there's no value in that set. It's a really weird thing. And Julia uses this type as kind of a subtype of every type. So every type, even concrete types, have subtypes, and that subtype is this union of empty the empty union. It used, the type used to be called none, but it was refused from the language because I think it's used somewhere deep in the bowels of the compiler when it figures out which function to call with which arguments and try to find out which set of functions are permissible. And then this may appear, but apart from that, from more type theoretical calculations, this empty union is not really useful. And real numbers, of course, are more numbers than just integers and floats. But if you have a union of integers and floats, that is either an integer or a float, then that is actually counts as a subtype of real. Using tuples, tuples are so-called immutable types. Once you have a tuple, you cannot modify it. If you have an array, as we had in this example, you can modify the array. Tuples cannot be modified. So we have a tuple here consisting of A, B, Z. If you take the second element of the tuple, it's of course B. If you try to set the second element to something else, that's an error because tuples can't be modified. There's no set index function. Two ways to do that. One is to explicitly deconstruct the tuple. You write index 1, index 2, index 3 of T1, and then reconstruct the tuple, but you replace the T1 of 2 with that letter E. Then you get what you'd expect. And you can also do it programmatically using an n-tuple function. So the n-tuple function is a function. The second argument is the length of the tuple. And the first argument is a function, a lambda expression, that takes as input an integer, and as output, it needs to output what the corresponding tuple expression should be. So here we use n-tuple. The length of t1, the tuple is 3. So that function is called for the values 1, 2, 3. For 2, it's ff. And for the other values, it's just the value of the old tuple. So the new tuple is a, ff, and c. A bit theoretical. I have a homework suggestion. Write a function that concatenates two tuples. Array concatenation in Julia is for historical reasons called vcat. There's also an hcat function. I think that is a notation that comes from Mathematica, sorry, MATLAB. In MATLAB, basically all data types are arrays. And if you have two arrays, you want to concatenate them. You can concatenate them horizontally or vertically. And a vector is essentially an array, a column vector. So if you want to concatenate two vectors, this would be a vertical concatenation. That's the natural one. So for tuples, the vertical concatenation, I mean, it has nothing to do with vertical anymore. We have 1, 2, and 3, 4 should be this. And if you want to play around with tuples, then you should try to write such a vcat function that works for tuples of arbitrary sizes. Alternatively, you can read the documentation of Julia about tuples, and you'll find something there about splatting. And that will give you an easier way than using the n-tuple function. Types in Julia are regular objects. We had that. So you can write functions that have types as input and types as output. For example, let's define a function nextInt, which kind of gives you the next large integer. I is the input. If the input is bool, that is, I mean, the input is not a Boolean value. It's the type Boolean. If the input is Boolean, we return an 8-bit integer. If the input is an 8-bit integer, 16-bit, and so on, and so on, and the 4. Let's just see. Forgot the 128-bit integers. Let me just add that here. And then we want to have a function that safely adds two numbers. Then we have two inputs, x and y, of the same type I. And then we call nextInt to get the next larger integer type, which is then a type that I call ny. And then we convert the inputs to ny, and then we add them. And then if there's an overflow, that overflow is averted. So type max int, that is the largest integer that can be represented, is 9, whatever, times 10 to the 18 or something. And if we add 1 to that, then we get the negative number because of integer overflow. And if you take this save addition function, what happened here? Oh, yes, the same expression. Then the result is actually correct, because internally it looked at the types of the inputs, determined the next larger integer type via the function that we wrote, converts to that type, and then return something that is then correct, avoiding the overflow. Of course, the save add function is probably slow because it needs to converge to a larger integer. Yep.
Can you go back just to the definition of save add?
Yep.
So what is the meaning of putting x dot dot semicolon semicolon or I? Is that saying that you're not restricting the type of x?
I'm kind of. Now, the type of x is not restricted, but the type of y is restricted to be the same of x. So there's a restriction on both types. And the other thing that it does, of course, it gives a name to the type I, so I can use the name here. Instead of doing that, I could also call the type of function and say I equals type of x, for example.
Okay, but in this expression, then the function learns from x what the type of x is.
Yes.
In a sense, the compiler picks which function to use. So there's a whole family of functions for each type, and it'll generate the one that.
Yeah, but this family exists anyway. Even if you just write save add x comma y, then there is also a function, a family of functions. So I actually used it to get the type. I mean, I wasn't thinking about that, to give a name to the type I because I didn't like calling a type of function, and just ensuring that x and y have the same type is just a side effect of the implementation. You can also pass types explicitly of parameters to a function. So this is similar to the save add function, a typed add, where you add two values, x and y, that kind of arbitrary types. But the first argument to the function t is a type. And then you convert x and y to that type t and add them. And for example, typed add, with an 8-bit integer, 2 and 3, the result is, of course, just 5, but it's an 8-bit 5. And if you try to do that with Boolean, so Boolean is an integer that is either 0 or 1, then, of course, you get a type error again because 2 can't be converted to Boolean, because Booleans have to be 0 or 1.
What's the difference between type and data type?
Haha, yeah. I have some examples further. So the thing is, since each value has a type, and each type has a type, you have this infinite hierarchy there. And that means some of the types that Julia uses are not explicitly represented. I mean, there is no data structure in memory. It's just programmatically represented. So data type is the thing that actually exists. But this type is kind of this programmatic type that is very convenient to use. But there, if you look at things, there are some slight inconsistencies with the use of functions. But nothing to worry about. No, I have actually an example with that a bit further down.
The same difference between concrete and abstract type?
Yeah, the kind of. So here, let me go to that example. Type of int, it says that it's data type. But that's not what you actually would use when you program. The type of int is type int. So this is the relation that you actually use in a program. So this type of int is kind of, it's a parameterized type, but this is the type that is not, that is only programmatically represented. So int is of type int, that is correct. And type int is a type that is correct. Is type int a data type? Yes. Is data type a type? Yes. And now you have a strange thing that if you try to draw the type hierarchy there, you get some strange, some inconsistencies. But you should not worry about that. What I actually showed you earlier with using data type, that is not what you would use. You would just use type of int or the generic type when you program. And that is internally something like data type. That is something that you should probably ignore. You see, the super type of int is actually any, and that is actually wrong. So this is some of that. Don't worry about the details here. You hear? Yes. There's another typed add function, which looks like this. So I'd like to compare the two. Can you actually see the typed add function down here? Yeah, OK. It's too far down. So here, I pass a value t, which is type. So t is a value in this function. And the type of t is actually type t. So here I define another function which is parameterized. It takes an argument which does not have a name, so you don't need to name an argument if you don't actually want to use it. But the type of that argument must be type of t, so this is how the parameter t is defined, and then I can use that parameter down here. So these two functions, type that and type that, actually have the same functionality, except here you're explicitly passing in a type at runtime, you're passing an object that needs to be analyzed, and here you're handling the type only via types itself, so the, at runtime nothing needs to happen. So the second function there is slightly more efficient. Since the type of a type is type of the, I don't know, I found it very confusing. And yeah, you can read that later and try to digest it. Anyway, just proving that SIMRUX as well. And I also wanted to show you that, just a brief glimpse, in Julia, since it's a dynamic language, whenever you define a function, you can also look at how the function looks under the hood to what it is compiled. You can actually, when a function is, you can see how it looks parsed, how it looks after the compiler has determined the types of the various local variables, and there's an immediate representation and the machine code, and LLVM is the intermediate representation. So let's look at the intermediate representation of this typed add function, and you see this is quite horribly complicated, that there's a lot of things. So there's some, do you see some? Store, yes, store writes something to memory, get element pointer gets something from memory, load also gets something from memory. There's alloc, a memory allocation. Anyway, there's a lot of stuff going on, and then since this just actually, this function just adds two numbers, you didn't expect all that stuff here. And if you look at the other function, typed add two, which was defined in a slightly different way. So then you see this is much cleaner and easier to understand. It has nice labels, pass and fail. So what this function does, there's the type, the first and the second argument. Percent one is the first argument. It does it, compares it, and there's a pass and fail. So this is just the comparison, whether this value, the first value, can be converted to an 8-bit integer or not. If it can't be converted, then the fail, which is the error message, then if it passes, it checks the second argument, fail is the error message, and finally down here, that is the actually code that is executed, and it's almost readable. It calls a trunc function, I64 to I8, so it truncates a 64-bit integer to an 8-bit integer, the actual addition that happens, and then it returns the result 11 of that addition. I don't expect you to actually understand that code, but if you're into this kind of thing, then you can get all the gory details of Julia without using an external disassembler or something. And yeah, this also shows that the second definition, which was this one here, with this way of defining the parameter t, is probably more efficient than the first one. Two small things about types. They're so-called value types. Sometimes you want to have a value, an integer value, and want to have it represented as a type. You want to kind of a mapping from integers to types. These are called value types. For example, if you write val1, that's a type that represents the digit, the number one. You can represent other numbers and look at the type. It's actually a type. And then it's this way of defining a factorial function. Usually, if you define a factorial function, computer scientists love factorial functions. You know, you need to have an if statement there. If the value, if the argument is zero, then the result is one. Else, you have to call the factorial function for n minus one and then multiply by n. And here, you can do it entirely in the type system, since the values are represented as type. If the type of the argument is zero, then you return one. And this is the generic definition for all n that holds as a fallback. In this case, the result is n times factorial of, well, you construct a value type of n minus 1. So what you do here, you construct a whole family of factorial functions of different arguments. Each of these arguments requires 0-bit to represent, but these arguments have different types and types for all integers. So if you call factorial of 100, it would construct 100 different factorial functions, each handling exactly one case. Sorry, go ahead. Yes, please ask. Maybe it helps.
I'm looking at second line, fact, factorial.
Yes.
N between parentheses.
That's the type parameter, yes.
So N is a number.
Yes. So parameters of functions can be types or numbers as well. That's the same as for arrays, the rank of the array for a 3D array, that was also a number.
So is that fact is a function?
Yes.
And I'm giving it type as a first argument, or what would
you say? So this is just a parameter, and this just means that this N is kind of a variable that will appear in the actual declaration here. But this function takes one argument, but we don't give a name to the argument. But the type of the argument must be a value type, and the value is just this parameter N.
Oh, okay. So this was the definition of a family of functions.
Yes, so it's a parameterized functions, and actually this is the generic definition, and this is a more specific definition where the value is zero. And in this case, of course, for the value zero, both would actually apply, but one of them is more specific than the other. Julia defines what specific means, and thus the one explicitly defined for zero would be called.
So fact of between curly brackets zero would give you one.
So, well, yes, this gives one. If you put zero in here, and then, of course, you get zero times something else, and you'd get an infinite recursion. You would not get one. So in principle, you have two conflicting definitions, but one of them is called more specific. Specific, that's a technical term, and then it will juice that. In that case, it means it's not generic. If you have a function that expects a particular argument type and a function that is parameterized, then the one with a particular argument type is more specific.
So even if you wrote this two in reverse order, if you first write the second line.
Yes, same thing. Order does not matter. Yes. So, for example, if you have a matrix multiplication routine, you can first write a very generic one, and then you can write a very efficient one if you have matrices of Booleans, because that can be handled more efficiently. And then, of course, if you evaluate this a few times, then we could just get the regular thing. So, value types that are not often useful, but sometimes you can do something cool with these kind of value types.
And that's where it's important what you said before, that the compiler will only evaluate the function for.
Yes, yes. Otherwise, of course, that infinite number of integers, and yes, you couldn't do that.
So only when inside N is some finite integer, then.
Yes, but it's still completely dynamic at runtime. So if at one time you want to know the factorial of 100, only then will it be compiled. Mm.
But it will compile 100.
Well, because of this recursive definition, it will go down to zero all the way. And if you omit, of course, that first definition for value zero, then you probably run out of memory. Mm.
And if I want to evaluate factorial of 100, and the next line is also evaluating factorial of 99, it will.
The methods are compiled only once and put into a cache.
Oh, so it will reuse it?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Actually, if you have a large package, for example, a graphics package, and you load it for the first time, it may take a minute or 2 minutes because it did. And the next time you load it, it's on a cache. The cache is even kept on disk. So even if you quit Julia and start it again, then it should be much faster. Mm. The nullable types, that's a concept that one also knows from C or C++. So you take a type, which is a set of values, and you add one extra out of band element, a null value. So in C or C++, if you have pointers, then you always get this null value in addition. For example, a pointer can point to all the valid objects, but the pointer can also be null, not point to any valid object. And that's quite convenient to have for pointers. And in Julia, this is generalized. You can do that for any types, even for integers and others. Internally, if it's an integer, you probably need an additional bit or something to specify whether the value is null. This is how you use that. You have a value of 1, and you wrap it in nullable. Then you get nullable of 1, which is, nullable is, of course, a parameters type, nullable of int. I hate nullable, but the name nullable, but whatever. And this is an empty nullable, which is then kind of called null. You can check whether each of these is null. Yes, and 0 is null. The second one is null. You can get the value back with the get function. If you have a null value and try to call get, it's, of course, an error. Hello, error, please show up. There you are. And you can specify default values. And then if there's nothing in there, you get the default value. And if you want to get more experience with Julia, nullable values, and so on, you can write a homework, a function. That function would expect two arrays. These arrays would both have elements of a nullable type. And then you add the arrays element-wise according to the following rules. If, well, both elements are non-null, then you add them, obviously. If one of the elements is null, you just take the other element. And if both elements are null, then the resulting element should also be null. Now, I'm giving you this homework, and I don't quite know whether you'll do the homework. I rather expect that you don't. So what we maybe should do is write this function here right now. Maybe that would help you. Maybe that would also give you a bit more experience. What do you think about that?
Let's do it.
Okay, sure. Let's write it. So let's begin. Someone tell me what to write.
I think we should just smile. We have all these people looking by, looking at us. I think they have all the money. Oh, you're recording this?
Yes. I don't know whether your voice makes it to the microphone. Okay. That's okay. Okay, how do we define a function? Let's begin with function, right? It's always a good way to write a function. So what we should call it? Okay. How do we continue? Yay, okay. So actually writing the signature of the function is already a bit complicated because we want the two arguments to be arrays of a nullable type. So how did that's one thing. How should I continue? Now it should be easy. Can you read it? Should I increase this font size? Oh, the green and black. Yeah, I hate that as well. Sorry. So the unreadable green ones are the curly braces around the nullable. How do we continue? T and U are parameters. So let's just write it like that. It's probably too complicated. I don't want to have to deal with the U, right? Let's just enforce both to be of the same type. Makes it easier. You like experience. So first we need to create an array where we can put the result. And there's a function in Julia called similar. This function should be the same as in MATLAB. So this creates an array with the same type, size, blah, 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 as x, but leaves it uninitialized. It's convenient. Otherwise, we'd have to look at the sizes and so on. Then we have a for loop. This was you, Jonah, right? Okay, go.
For I in 1, colon, x.
Okay. Yeah, you can also do that. And then?
R of I.
Yeah. So I think people, on one hand, are a bit overwhelmed by the lecture and find it kind of boring. But without this kind of practical exercise, you also can't follow. So I really think you should actually do the homework at home and get this kind of practical exercise. And that means you get a bit of experience. And also makes it easier to follow the lecture because the concepts that I'm representing, are they not as abstract as if you just learn about it. A language in an abstract way. If you're just discussing the language without you ever doing any homework and doing anything, then I don't think most of you will get anything useful out of it.
Now I'm fighting with two things. One is I came here, I did the homework, 100 from 1 to 10.
Very good.
But there was no each index, or there was no similar, you know.
Yeah, so this similar and each index is just me being fancy. If this was Homburg, then you could also write, for example, error equals copy x, right? You just make a copy of x, which is not as efficient, but it would work. And instead of each index, you could write 1: length of x, which is what Jonah suggested. So these are all perfectly fine ways. So this is kind of the most perfect Homburg example. But if you do something else, it's fine, because there are 100 million ways to do that Homburg.
That's kind of what I'm saying is that I'm trying to understand the constant nullable, which is a bit weird to me. But at the same time, if I try to write this function, I don't have the basic.
Yes, yes. So when you do your homework, you probably spend 2 minutes thinking about the concepts, 10 minutes fighting with the syntax, where to put the curlies and the colons and whatever, and a half an hour going through the manual and looking at the various functions. But in the end, this is probably the most efficient way to learn something. So there's only one way to learn a language, and that's the hard way. So that. Okay. 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 I put a space afterwards so the line continues. How does it go on? Okay, so we have the function. Let's evaluate it. let's define some arrays, right? An array. Oof, that's complicated. Now we need to create an array of nullable values. Oh, what was that? So I'm just using the same syntax as above to create. yeah, thank you. Something's wrong. Oh no, there we are. And it looks bad. Sorry, I'm just fighting. Get a nice display here on the stream, on the screen. So let's look at what we did here. This is a 4 array element with nullable ints. The first element is null. That's these empty parentheses. But null is not equals null, right? There's a difference between a null integer and a null floating point value and so on. The different null values are not all the same. So this is an integer null, and then we have 1 and 2, and again an integer null. The second array, I permuted the ordinals. First we have 4, then null, and 5, and null again. And what do we expect as the output? According to the rules, there we have null plus 4, which should just be 4. Very good. Then we have 1 plus null, which should be 1. That is good. And then we have 2 plus 5, 2 non-null values. We actually need to add them. Give 7. That is good. Then we have 1 null value and another null value. And the result should be null again, but instead we have zero. So there's a bug in the code somewhere.
In which code is there a bug?
The code, this one here that we wrote.
So what does get?
So if you have a nullable value, then get gets the value out of the nullable value.
So is that okay?
So it's something like dereferencing a pointer or getting an array
so
element.
If it was empty, seems to be getting a zero instead.
Yes, so this is what we did with the get zero. If you just write get x of I, you get the value out, and it's an error if there's no value there. If you write get x comma zero, then you get the value out, or you get the zero if there's no values there. It's kind of a default value that you get.
But that's why you have a zero.
That's exactly, yes. But I didn't write the code. You did, so you fix it. Ah, okay. Where do you want it?
R of I equals F. Yes, is no X of I, and is no Y of I. No.
Yeah, you have to write it that way. Sorry. Yeah, that is a bit difficult to read, right? So let me add some line breaks in here. Yep, that's that one. So I assume if you, without knowledge of Julia, had done that yourself, you probably would have taken you half an hour or something to do that. Not because the logic is complicated, but because you need to take care of all the details and all the specifications and do quite a bit of manual studying and so on. But you probably need to get familiar with the manual, not with the details, but kind of with a table of contents so that next time you need something, you just know how to look up something. Or the, aha, wait. I have the manual open here. We could have done that. If you look at nullable here, essentials, why not? Looks good. Nah, that's not it. Types. Oh, man, I happen to know it's on this page, but it's at the bottom. I was hoping that, yeah, there, nullable types. Because I looked for nullable, all the nullable lists is actually highlighted nicely. Anyway, I was hoping that actually it would directly put you at the bottom of the page, but apparently it doesn't. So this is just that kind of wordy explanation of the same thing, what I said, wanted to say, or should have said, but all the details.
So this has nothing to do with future?
No, no, this has nothing to do with the future. There is a connection that, of course, they're very similar. So nullable is what is called a functor, and it either holds zero or one values. And the future holds a value or will hold the value in the future. And in C++, if you have a shared pointer, then that shared pointer either points to a value or the pointer is null, and so on. So this is a very similar concept. You can also think of it as an array that has either zero or one elements. If it's zero element, that corresponds to null, and if the array has one element, that corresponds to a nullable value that actually holds a value.
I was the one talking about that I wanted to show off the fact that if statements return values.
Ah, thank you. Yes, yes. I was going to say that because I noticed you doing that. So no, say it.
So if statements behave basically like functions. So the syntax if blah else blah n is a function that returns what it should based on the if condition. And that's why you can set r equal.
So if will return false, or what will return? If the condition is fulfilled.
If the condition is fulfilled, it will return.
Sorry, the indentation here was confusing.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, because there's no then in, or no braces or colons or something.
What's the type of E?
Pardon?
What's the type of E?
The type? So if doesn't have a type, but if this is true, then whatever type this one has is the type of the return value. And if this is false, it would evaluate this one. So if returns a value, and each value has exactly one type, and that is the type of the if statement. So you can also use the question mark operator, which is probably more familiar to you. So you would write this one, then a question mark, then this one, then a colon, and then this line instead of if, else, and the same order. Yes?
Could we also redefine addition for the nullable in the type? Like, could we just add?
Yes. Very good. Very good. There's an ongoing discussion in Julia whether this just shouldn't be the case. Because in many cases, it's kind of obvious how you want to handle things if you have a missing value. For example, if you add something and one value is null, no, then it should be replaced with a neutral value for addition, similar for multiplying numbers and so on. And similar if you want to look for a maximum, minimum, if you want to output something and so on. But in other cases, it's actually important to keep the notion of null. For example, floating point numbers, they don't have a null number, but they have something called not a number. And that not a number, if you add something plus not a number, the result is not the number, but the result is again not a number. So it's kind of an infectious idea that if you have a not a number in some place, then anything else will also get not a number. And that's good for error propagation. If you get not a number, square root of minus one, this is not a number, and then everything else will be affected. In the end, in the result, you see what was affected by that and not. And it may well be that you get not a number in some place, and the result happens to be unused, and then it's not bad that anything happened. And that is kind of the opposite of using the neutral element, so these two competing notions. And the current conclusion in Julia is that this nullable will remain as it is. I mean, you can define this plus, but it may not work. And there are other implementations where it will actually just be treated as null. For example, there is a package for handling data, experimental data. They introduce a data type called a data frame. And data frames can be NA. I don't know why it's called NA, probably from MATLAB history, which means that frame doesn't exist. And in that context, what you want is just ignore it. So if you want to get the average of all data frames, you not only want that element, that data frame, to be counted as zero, you also, if you count the number of frames, you want this thing to not be counted. And kind of, if you then take the average, then the NAs will just be ignored as if they hadn't been there. But this is not what null does. But in this case, yes, we could have done that, yes. Good. A short excursion about mathematical constants. There's a pi, of course, built in, which looks like that. If you look at the type of pi, da, 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 da. Yeah, I was going to come up and talk about that. It's the irrational number pi. So pi internally is not represented as a double precision number, but as a special construct. And depending on how you use that construct, it will convert itself to the respective thing. So if you convert it to a 16-bit number, then it's 3.14 boring. If you convert it to a big float, it's one of these arbitrary precision things, then you get a whole lot of numbers, probably about 100 or something. And of course, if you use double precision, you only get 16 digits or something. And there are other constants built in that way. There is E and gamma constant and so on and so forth. And to indicate that fact, pi is represented with dot, dot, dot. In other languages, you have several versions of pi, one for each different type, because if you use a double precision pi in a quadruple precision calculation, then of course the calculation is ruined because pi was the wrong number. A short section on functions. This is how you define functions. One syntax, you just f of x and then equals and the value. That's good for one line definitions. Oh man, my voice is giving out. I should stop soon. You can use the function syntax, function f2 of x is x plus y, and you probably want to write that on multiple lines. Let's do that. And you can also define a function using a closure, a lambda expression. So f3 is then a value, and x goes to x plus 1 is an anonymous function. If you programmed in Mathematica, you probably know that. That would be the ampersand notation with a hash symbol. And of course, if you call each of them, you get the same result. Okay. You may remember that I was sick last week. I'm actually still sick this week. I think I celebrated too much on Thanksgiving or something. And since my voice is giving out, I'll stop here. I was going to say more about traits and the type system, but I think I can't do that. So we'll continue with that next week. Thank you.